This is David Soselsky, Southern Oral History Program, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is another in the Listening for a Change series. Today is May 25th, 1999. I'm in Elizabethtown, North Carolina, and I'm interviewing Mrs. Adele McDowell. I'll be looking at this for the sound quality. I do want to say that we're also here today with Mr. William T. McDowell, Ms. McDowell's son. Okay. And you may have to hold it even closer, just like, yeah, like you were singing or something. How would you tell the story if you were being called into, I don't know, a class of young people today, almost, that knew nothing about Elizabethtown and the mill, and you were trying to tell them what it was like? Because that's kind of almost the, you know, when I interview people, I think about people who will hear this story 100 years from now, and will be trying to imagine what it was like. Where would you start the story?
The way of life in Elizabethtown in the early 40s was an agriculture area, lumbering, and a lot of the women worked domestic work. And the men worked at the lumber mill, which was Green Brothers, and they made like 65 cents an hour. That was the price they paid during that time. And we had some union workers to come in the community to help the workers to make better salaries. And that was Jimmy Compton and Jackson. Jimmy Compton was from Hagerstown, Maryland, and Jackson was from Winston-Salem. So they organized this strike, and my husband was one of the main men to help to get this organized. And they had, they were on strike, and they didn't make a salary while they were on strike. And the union had this store that gave them food and maybe a small donation a week.
A commissary kind of.
Commissary, that's right. While they were on strike. And the men struck and they had a picket line. And they weren't supposed to go into the mill. The men weren't supposed to cross the picket line.
Right.
And then there were some men that were still working. And when they lined up, the men was working. One that worked for Green Brothers, he drove the car, and they always had big Cadillacs, and they would try to run over the men in the line.
I read about that in the newspaper.
You did?
Will showed it to me, yeah.
Yes. And now,
And the police would?
They didn't do that much about it. The police wouldn't do anything about it. They encouraged it, I think. My husband would tell me what was going on, and I stayed on edge all the time when he would come in, wondering what would be the next day, what would happen.
You were worried about that he'd get hurt.
I was worried that he might get hurt,
yeah.
Right. And it went on for a long, long time. My boys were young. The older one that's sitting here was about 9, going in 10, and Lorenzo was 6.
Fourth,
6.
Fifth grade.
I remember this right. You know, the guy that was here the last time that was talking, when I was talking with him, he was saying that, when he was saying about fear for your life, He was saying that three policemen came to his house and asked him, how would you feel if...
Do you mind?
No.
It's not picking up. I'm looking at the gauge here. It's picking you up perfect, but it's not picking you.
No. You know, he was saying that three policemen came to his house and they asked him, say, how would you feel if your family had to be without you, or if something would happen to them? And he said that, you know, he knew exactly what they meant and what they were expecting him to do. And they was, because he was like one of the people that was up front with the, right, with the strike. And he said he was really frightened about it. And so I listened to him, and I felt that the reason why right now that he doesn't want to really deal with it, being 85 now, he felt that it was just too much pressure for him to,
sure,
to come back and try to deal with again.
Yeah.
But I think that the strike itself, it, when it comes down to the way that the people, you know, feel now, and even dealing with my father himself over the years as he got older, I could tell that a lot of the things that were experiences, the experiences that he had, that even me being as young as I was at that time,
right,
I didn't see as being like hard times, but it developed a lot of things in me that made me want to move on and do a lot of things better, and even so that things would be much better for me, you know, because of the fact that I was hearing the things, but I wasn't able at that time to put it together. But as I got older,
right,
I understood when
he... As a child, these things are kind of out there around you, but right, you don't really...
Right. And as I got older, I understood when he said I had a hard time. And when he started getting sick, he said that a lot. I had a hard time in life.
Yeah.
And I can remember when, you know, he asked me to try to accept some of the responsibilities of the family, you know.
When you were what, about what age? When you were,
I was right at 40.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he asked me would I just kind of, and he was, I guess, in maybe about 66 there.
Uh-huh.
And you know, things began to become, sure, pressure to him. Mm-hmm. And you know, I always looked at him as a person that I felt that he could do it, whatever he needed to do. He had strength. Mm-hmm. I always could see that part of him. I saw one part that he wasn't able in some ways to express himself, and the genuine feeling that he had, I knew it because of the fact that he always exhibited love to family.
Right.
And he exhibited to community, to church and all.
Uh-huh.
And it was a part of him. Even the guy that came from Hagerstown,
Jimmy Compton,
and the other guy, one of the guys became a minister after that because of the fact that he saw the fears and the division of people,
right,
and the things that cause people to be divided, not to be able to come together and, mm-hmm, and be a stronger community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of the things that happen is probably a reason for some of the weaknesses that the community even right now experience.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go back and you look at statistics, you probably say that Bladen County is probably one of the poorest communities in North Carolina.
I would think so. Yes.
You know, yeah. And there's a lot of reasons for that.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know whether it's going to eventually down the line somewhere, whether it's going to affect the, you know, whether or not it's going to be able to support itself.
Right.
Or whether or not they're going to have to come, you know, they're going to have to put more money to, the state going to probably have to put more money to invest here to try to help people come to a point where, right, they can be self-supporting and be, mm-hmm, able to make more and profit more from staying here, because most of us had to leave and go away,
right,
make a living, to make a decent living.
Yeah.
I went to Washington, I worked in the police department for 21 years.
And came home. Me and your mama.
Yeah. And I thought about most of the people that, and we had some really highly skilled people. You know, there's a guy that was a classmate that was a salutatorian
in the class. He just retired from NIH, and he was one of the people that distributed money across the country for cancer research.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Like a brain drain.
And we have one guy that was a year ahead of me, that retired from the military, John Badeau. Mm-hmm. And he retired as a full bird colonel from the Air Force, flying B-52 bombers.
Right.
You know, I mean, and you know, you see that there's so much. You know, children just have so much, and like right now, I'm trying to start an organization here for young people. Mm-hmm. You know, so that they would know and get the type of resources that they need in order mm-hmm. to be successful in life. Mm-hmm. And I look at it from more than one way. I look at it that the more that we feed into young people, even once we become older, the better support system we're going to have.
Right.
You know, when you go to the hospitals, right. You go to nursing homes, when you get services in the community together. And I don't know why, you know, people, and I try to, you try to keep that open mind, because I guess when people have really hard times, you know, they, a lot of things that, you know, comes inside that they feel that they don't know how to deal with. And if they don't have someone they can really communicate with and learn how to deal with these things, then they become bitter feelings, you know.
Right.
And I guess the exposure that I've had being in Washington, probably one of my greatest experiences, you know, one of my greatest experiences in life. And then with the military, too, you know, I went in the military for 2 years. And I think those experiences are some of the greatest ones that I've had. And understanding some of the things that I went through in childhood, and mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. and you know, just like right now, if I was a wealthy man, I would do something for everybody in this town. You know, it wouldn't be nothing with color, or it would be white, black.
Right.
It wouldn't make any difference.
Sure.
You know, and that's something that walking day to day, that you can feel good about, you know, and you can really feel good right. that you're that healthy, you know, that you want to help everybody.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask your mom what else she remembers about the.
Okay.
What we were talking about the guy in the Cadillac running through the line. What else do you remember from the strike?
I remember Mr. Compton getting hurt one night, and I never knew just he got his leg broke. I didn't find out just how it happened. Mm-hmm. They didn't ever say. But my husband, he was really, I say, humiliated, because so many of the workers, they didn't have their own homes, you know. Mm-hmm. They lived in the houses that Green Brothers had built. They call it the quarters. And all the workers lived there. And they had a store called a commissary. That was where they went and bought their groceries. And they were charged from week to week, you know.
Mm-hmm. Came out of their paycheck.
Came out of their paycheck.
Yeah.
That's true. So then Thomas started talking, that was my husband, to them about, after the strike, my husband didn't ever get back to the mill. Some of the men went back, mm-hmm. but he told them about purchasing land to buy, to build a home for themselves, mm-hmm. and move out of the quarters. So they did, and a lot of them did, and that was helpful.
Mm-hmm. To get some freedom from being right under the Green Brothers.
That's yeah. right. So
they had to purchase all of their food and clothing and everything from the commissary too. Mm-hmm. And I think I heard one guy say that he knew people that lost their job because they had bought items other places.
What were you going to say?
I was just thinking about this guy that drove the Cadillac, tried to run over them in the picket line. Mm-hmm. Did I tell
you? Yeah. let's go back a little ways and start with just like had the Green Brothers been here for a long time? Where did they come from? And
the Green Brothers came here from Alabama, mm-hmm. and they had been here. They came in the early 30s, uh-huh. and they brought quite a few of these people with them.
They brought people from.
Yes, they stopped along the way. They had a mill in Cedar Creek, and they picked up people in different areas where the mill were.
Where's Cedar Creek?
That's out from Federal, isn't it?
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yes, Cedar Creek is up. Uh-huh. 53.
So. Okay, so they brought workers from all those places?
Yes.
Here?
That's right.
It was a big place.
A big place.
The mill.
The mill was a big place. You know where the Walmart store is up uh-huh. there? That's where the mill was.
What did it look like? If you'd never seen a mill, what did it look like?
Well, it was a big building, and they had the equipment there to make the logs.
They had stacks of logs. I can remember that all the way back to childhood.
Yeah,
there was two mills in Elizabethtown. One is where Food Folks is now, right here, uh-huh. where McDonald's is.
Right.
The next block, that whole block, was the mill. We call the Hall Mill.
The Hall Lumber Company.
Hall Lumber Company. Uh-huh. And they were in operation, and Green Brothers, because those two mills.
And tell me more about how it looks in your words. Was it loud? Was it smoky? Was it
It was noisy. It was noisy because they did all that sawing there. You know, the logs. Uh-huh. And they had to haul the material away that. When they trimmed the logs, uh-huh. and then they made lumber from the logs. And the material that they trimmed from the logs, they carried it down on the other side of the highway, and they had wood down there. And the wood was sold to the workers.
Okay.
They had trucks that delivered the wood. Uh-huh. Some call them dump trucks.
Yeah.
And they would bring the wood to you for $5 a load. And then after the strike, they stopped letting you get the wood, and they started burning the wood over there at Cape Fear River back there.
And
I think they were offended, you know.
Yeah. And where did they log? Did you know that? Where were they bringing the
from over the county, from different Green what? Brothers had bought property, and they saw the logs in the woods, and they haul them up there to the mill.
Was it one place? Was it what, Collie Swamp? Is that what they
called? Collie Swamp.
Is that what they?
That's right.
Okay.
Trucks of logs would come in, and they would. Dress them, I guess you call it, at the mill over there.
What end of things did your husband work?
He stacked lumber when he was there.
And kind of spell that out for me, if you would. What exactly did he do? Did he describe what he did to you? I mean,
it was a lot. He was a lumber stacker. What would you call?
And what's that mean? That you
different grades of lumber they. You know, they sorted it.
Uh-huh. So he grades it, and then what, you put it in different piles?
Different piles, that's right. The great aluminum grader. He put it in different piles.
They probably cut it different ways. Like, yeah. You have 2x4s, you have
right.
1x4s, mm-hmm. you know.
And that day, is that something you did by hand, or is something they must have machines?
They had machines to saw it, you know. Yeah.
And then, but when he stacked it, did they?
They stacked it by hand.
They stacked it by hand.
Yeah.
And they did have a lift that would hop. What you call it, a lifter?
Yeah.
They stacked it.
Yeah.
Because that whole area up there was just a big lumber yard. No stores were up there. You know where the Winn-Dixie store is?
Yeah, I passed it.
All over there. It was lumber all around.
And that's where he would have been, in the lumber yard?
In the lumber yard.
So he wouldn't have really been like that. The sawmill was the building.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Was it hard on him? Was it hard work?
It was hard work. They would leave 6 in the morning and come back 6 in the afternoon.
And
it was a rough day. And they made 65 cents an hour.
Any benefits?
They come with brother now. He probably remember more than anybody. That just got a bad laugh. Come to memory.
Come on in.
I'll turn around for a second. So when he came home, he was tired?
Oh, yes. He was always tired. He was a strong man, though, you know. He worked hard, and he was healthy. And he was busy in organizations such as they were at that time. He encouraged the people to build homes of their, to buy land and build homes of their own.
Did he ever talk about... what was the work was like for the other workers, like in the mill or down in the log woods?
Well, he didn't work in the log woods, but he was at the mill all the time.
Yeah.
But
I wonder if did
they were a group of men that went to the log woods.
Did you ever hear what that work was like, or
sawing the trees and loading them on the trucks? Sometimes men would get hurt. Sometimes they would break their limbs, you know, the legs or whatnot.
Yeah, I've always heard horror stories about logwood.
Yeah, logwood.
Well, I lost my grandpa.
Is that right? I remember a guy that was ahead of me in school that came out of school and went in the logwoods. He lived in the quarters. And he was Nathaniel Hill.
Mm-hmm.
He was killed in the logwood.
Yeah, we had several people to be killed.
You know, where trees... I think when it was began to fall, it kicked back,
right,
and it struck him in the chest.
And I've heard all kinds of stories when those first chainsaws people were using,
yeah,
yes,
where the chains would come off,
right.
All kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of man was your husband then?
He was.
I know that's hard to describe for his wife, but what kind of at that time he was in his. Early, mid-20s or something like that?
Yes, mid-20s, early 30s. He was a Christian man. He was a church worker. And
he had grown up right here?
Yes, he grew up right here.
Uh-huh.
And he was a good church worker. He was chairman of the trustee board and...
Even when he was young, he was active in the church.
He was active in the church when he was young.
Seems like a lot of men come to it a little later.
Yes. Through the earlier part of his life, he started with the church.
Why? What was it about him that made other people want to elect him president of the union?
They had confidence in him. They trusted him. They said, if you want someone to tell you the truth, you ask Thomas McDowell. Say, he will tell you the truth. And now, he was a good leader. He had followers.
Did he have a reputation of standing up to people?
Yes. That's right. He did.
I think it was more that he stood up for what he believed in.
He stood up for what he believed in. That's true.
And
Had anything happened before the, like before the union? Were there? I guess I'm trying to understand why, even you know, why those guys elected him. He must have shown them something, and are there things? Are there ways that he showed that leadership? Because a good church leader, you want a man you can trust, but a good church leader isn't necessarily a good union president who's going to stand up to threats or put up with fear. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I understand. He wasn't afraid to venture out in what he believed in.
And what do you think he believed in?
He was honest and truth-worthy. And
I think that a lot of it was that he felt that that people should be able to take care of their families and should be responsible. And one of the things that I learned from my father was that a man's responsibility is to provide, protect, and minister to his family. Uh-huh. And that was one of the things I think he believed in that. Even when going back to my grandfather, you know, I knew a lot about my grandfather because my grandfather didn't die until I was about 15, 16. And that was some of the things that I can remember that he said to me, uh-huh. You know. And, you know, a lot of people were like, you know, scanning the surface.
Right.
They weren't firm about anything. They didn't have... Because my grandfather, I remember when I was 13 years old, my grandfather said, if you want to find yourself going no place, then follow somebody that's going nowhere. And you know, and whatever you start, complete it. Those are just things that he said. And right now, those are some of the best skills that I have. You know, if I start something, I'm going to try to finish it.
Well, was it, so he thought that the working conditions, the way the workers at Green Brothers were treated, were in opposition to those things he believed, that they didn't
I think he had a clear identity of what was fair and what was unfair. And you know, and I think that he was willing to put a little bit more on the line for what he felt was fair and unfair. And because back during that particular time, even now,
yeah,
people were close to as far as groups,
right,
than they are now. More people are more. They do things on an individual basis now.
That's true.
You know, and they feel like that I'm independent. I can work out this for myself.
It's myself.
And they don't realize the strength of being together, yeah, in groups.
Do you remember when he was elected union president?
Yes, I remember.
What happened? Were you there?
I wasn't in the meeting when he was elected, but I do remember when he was elected. Everybody wanted him to be the president. They thought that Thomas would make a good one. It's been a long time.
I know it has. And when he comes home and tells you, did you got? Were you surprised or worried?
I was worried at times when he would tell me what went on, mm-hmm, you know, because it was, as Reverend Cotton said, that was something going on at that time.
Something going on.
He says something's going on.
I bet.
Yes.
I bet. And I'm not saying asking you to really remember, but do you think you would have said, like, been surprised when he came home and said, I was elected union president? Or would you have just said, well, that's Thomas being Thomas. You know, of course he's going to be, I mean.
Yes, I'd say that's Thomas being Thomas.
you were used to him.
Yes. Yeah. Venturing out for things, you know.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Do you remember things that he had done like that before? I mean, that venturing out before the union? Even little things.
He Yeah, he'd like to be the leader in community affairs.
Like what kinds of things? Like the church?
The church.
Yeah, he was in the Masons.
In the Masons. Uh-huh. He was a Mason. He was in the church. He was chairman of the trustee board, and he was very active in the church.
Do you think that his
But now, let me just mention this. They had what they started, like, there were people that came up and put shares in, and one of the other things that he started was, like, they had a sewing factory.
It was the Cape Fear Development.
The Cape Fear Development. He was one of the people that was in the lead with that, you know, putting it together.
And this was before the strike?
Yeah, this was before the strike.
Was the Cape Fear the thing before the strike or after the strike? Was that Cape Fear Development before or after?
Maybe it was after.
Because that organization just went out of existence. I think most of the people that were my father's age just finally died out. But then they came together with what you call Bladen County Development
Fund.
Incorporation or something.
Uh-huh.
They what they did, it was a non-profit organization that they had organized, and then they came together with another organization, and they took over. In other words, all of the money from their organization went into this organization because they had the same type of tax status. Right.
And that was where they organized this
NGBL.
Yeah, and they had a sewing plant. The women were working in the homes, you know.
Uh-huh.
And they wanted to develop jobs for them.
Uh-huh. So it was like a cooperative kind of thing.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, do you think that the that if you had to place his motivation in standing up with the workers, do you think a lot of it came from his Christianity? Do you think a lot of it was How would we articulate that? How would we? And how does, like the Bible, in you and your husband's words, like how would it speak to that? Do you think, like in his mind, can you imagine what would have been the connection between his faith and his willingness to venture out like this? Some people would say, well, it's a worldly thing. I can imagine 100 ministers that would say, I'm not getting involved because this is an affair of, you know, this world I have my eye on. But, and other people look at it different, and how would are we going out on a limb
no,
here?
I understand where you are because of the fact that I think that a lot of things that I believe came from, you know, from my, you know, me talking to my father and a lot of the things that he expressed and the way that he expressed them, you know. And I think that the way that he looked at life is that I live every day. I go to church on Sundays, and I'm in church, and everybody know when I come, I state my purpose, and I state my feelings, and as far as being the Christian that I am, and I live it every day when I go to the job and the things that I do. But I think that he, deep down inside, that he wanted to show people how to live that Christian life, even in their job, because that's the type of respect that he carried. By the way he presented himself. And he did it even when he came in touch with other people, females, my mother and everybody, the type of respect. And he felt that if I'm going to be something, I have to first earn it and I have to be,
right,
you know, deserving of it. And he always said that. He says, if you want people to respect you, you got to give respect and you got to do things that's going to give you respect in return. And those are the kinds of things. And he even told people that. I mean, you know, I could think about people in the family when I can even go back to
one of my first cousins, when he was in disagreement with something that she was doing, right. and he went to her personally and said that, I do not approve of this. Right. And he says, and I'm expressing it to you out of love, mm-hmm. you see. And that was the type of person that he was. And I don't think that he ever did anything out of hate. He's ever done anything that, because of the fact that he was angry with somebody doing it, you know, because he knew how to separate himself from those parts and those people, you know.
Is that how you see it?
Yeah, that's the way I see it. Yes, he was. And he was uplifting.
Yeah.
He was really.
How do you mean exactly? That he was. How do you mean exactly?
Yeah, he was encouraging, you know, to you, and just to hear him and you deal with him, it would give you a sense to want to go forward, and he uplifted me, and now I think about him, you know, in his condition.
Yeah.
I had to call from Washington down here and tell her to give up some of the positions she had in church. You know, when my father started getting sick.
Yeah.
She was reading the announcements. She was a leader. She was on the financial committee. She was everywhere. She had about 10, 11 positions in the church. You know, and, you know, what she's saying is really, you know, Trump, you know, you got to do something, you know, and they would talk about it. They talked, you know. One thing that I can say about this house is that when we said something, when something was discussed here, it never went outside without his permission. Uh-huh. You know, right. We could talk openly as a family.
Right.
You know, and, you know, and my mother, she knew that, uh-huh. you know, and we knew as children that anything that we wanted, all we had to do is go to her. she could get it from him.
Children figure that out pretty quick.
she could get it from him.
Yes.
Yeah, we do that.
Well, what were you doing during the strike?
I was just at home. I was the housewife.
And you had.
But I did work after the boys got up. I worked as an assistant in the school system.
Uh-huh. That would have been later.
That was later.
Uh-huh. How many children did you have?
The two boys that yes, the two boys.
Did you go to any of the strike events? Were there things that you were involved in to support the strike?
No, I don't think I went to too many of them. The men mostly were there, you know.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember the wives being in any of the meetings. The men were there.
Were there ever events to support like the men, the workers' morale? Did they ever have remember anything like that?
I guess they were afraid to get out too much. Yeah, they were afraid to get out too much, but they
prayer
went.
Meetings, were there ever anything like that? Was there?
Well, we went to prayer meeting, and they prayed. You know, the minister would pray for the success of the strike.
Uh-huh. You said that there was actually like a union chaplain.
Yes.
And
I said, I wish that I had. You know, then we didn't keep records like this.
We didn't. What kind of stories did he tell? Only if it's okay to.
Yeah.
Are there any stories he told that we can tell?
Do you remember any of them?
I haven't talked to Reverend Cotton about any of this. You know, I just talked to Mr. Carey.
Reverend Cotton is still alive. He has arthritis.
But now he has a good mind. Now he can sit down and tell you some things. He's probably in his 90s.
No, he said he told me he'll be 89 his next birthday.
Yeah, well, I know he's.
But he has his good mind.
Yeah.
Did he tell you any stories that were interesting to you?
No, he just told about the condition and the workers and how they treated them and how they tried to run over them in the picket line. Uh-huh. So they would go and get the big Cadillacs and come back and try to...
Well, he was telling things, you know. I think she... He was saying something. She was telling me last night when she talked to him. She said that this guy that he just died, I guess, about 6 months ago. Mr. Tyson, he said that when all this was going on.
We'll talk to him.
Say that we gonna have it rough. Say, but you got to stand up and say that old Reed Tyson will start crying. See.
You know, he said that, you know, things were just so hard. He said just bad. He said just broke down. And I all through my childhood and seeing him at church, you know, and him pray, you know, and he just had so, and he was just so genuine, you know, with his prayer and everything, you know. And when he was telling that, you know, and I knew all of them were real close, you know, when this coming along. But see, when they were all much younger. I think Mr. Tyson probably was about 96 when he died.
He died in January. He had a good mind, too. I wish you could.
But we'll talk to him. Will did do an interview with Rory Tyson.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
I thought so. There was a...
Maybe so.
I'm almost sure there were two Tyson brothers, weren't
there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wayman and Ori. And Wayman is still in the nursing home in Clarkson.
Now, I think he talked to both of them, but yes. I could be wrong and he only talked to one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think he talked to...
He probably did.
Both of them.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. they both had strong minds.
They had both come from Alabama.
Alabama.
Yeah.
Right.
I know he got talked to at least one of them. And I think mm-hmm. I saw the name, you know, because it rings a bell. And I remember that they came from Alabama.
Yes.
So I think he talked to them.
Yes.
I'll tell Will that Ori passed.
Yes, he passed in January.
And now Mr. Wayman is still in Clarkton in the nursing home.
He comes home.
But now he has his good man.
Yeah.
But he just had, you know, he can't take care of himself. His legs are bad, and knees are bad.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think his heart was too weak for them to do a replacement. They chose not to do it.
Let me look at my little questions here. You said sometimes you'd hear stories about about people being hurt in the mail. I was just trying to understand a little bit more about why, what conditions were like that would have the men take this risk to organize the union. I mean, was it just because they were making 65 cents an hour? I mean, I don't mean to be, you know, flip or anything, but it was 1948, and life for black people in the South was a 65 cents an hour kind of life.
Yes.
So a lot of people, I mean, everybody needed improvement. I mean, a lot. I'm trying to understand, what was it about Green Brothers that made them go out on a limb like this? Like, what was it about working there, or?
Well, that was the only thing to do other than farming. You know, the sawmill.
Uh huh.
And a lot of them left the farms and went into the sawmill. That was.
Now, most of them would rather work in a sawmill than a farm.
Yes, a lot of them would rather work in a sawmill than a farm.
What do you think that is? That's...
Well, I think that, and I can go back that far.
Yeah.
You know, I think that what happened is that the people, there was a select group of people, the people that only owned this little spot where they live, didn't own anything at all. They had to go with the choices that they had. The farm was almost like the mill. If you farm for a farmer, you lived in the house on the
a tenant house.
A tenant house,
mm-hmm. right?
You know, mm-hmm. and that's where you got your start from.
There was no freedom there either.
No, there was no freedom there. You just worked 24 hours a day, whenever you needed. Mm-hmm. You know,
from sun to sun.
So it was still the choices, and I think that you had that same. Now that I've gone back and probably processed some of this, I probably processed it probably fairer than most people would have, because I looked at it from all the different angles, you know. And a lot of people don't want to remember things, but then what was in existence is that mill had homes for the people that was there, right. Majority of them. There were people there that was there that was not in the homes.
Right.
But they were few.
They were few.
Yeah. And see, with the same thing with, even with my grandfather owned a lot of land. And even when...
This is your father's father?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And when back during that time, what Papa had something in the neighborhood of about 450 acres of land. And he had people farming for him. And the guy lived, he had a house where out on the Peanut Road that the guy lived in, but what happened, he bought that spot and he lived his own house, but he still, right. He still tend the farm, and he got, you know, it's like a share farm.
Right.
You know, he got his portion of it. He bought all the materials, did all of that, but he was responsible for it.
That's true.
So if you were sharecropping or tenant farming, the mill looked like a...
Yeah. It was built all on that same basis.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And y'all didn't live in the quarters.
No, we didn't live in the quarters.
You live right here.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. This was an old house.
It's an old house.
It's a renovated house.
Doesn't look old now. But, and what was life like in the quarters? Was it a rough place,